All right. Well, thank you so much once again. Thank you for the engaging conversations during the course of lunch. I also want to thank you for your politeness in letting me actually have lunch. Sometimes when you're a speaker, you don't get to actually eat because folks want to talk with you, which is food enough. It really is. But thank you. And also for the delicious food, by the way. That was pretty amazing. How about we give a hand for those people who made the food? Wow. I've spoken at men's conferences, and you guys have definitely stepped it up. what I want to speak about this in this next session, I sort of alluded to in the first one, where there was this phenomenon about how we come to truth, how we actually approach truth in terms of our own personal discovery or our own personal journeys. And what I want to point out is that people don't always come to truth. We think that people will come to truth and suddenly see the light or see the logic behind our argumentation. You'll give an argument, that argument will be sound, it'll be backed up by evidence, and a rational person will sit across the table from you, and they'll look at you, and they'll smile, and they'll nod politely, and they'll wait for you to get done talking, and then they won't have gotten anything you said. Or, you're that person. Kind of depends. You know, we have a thing, I call it yeah, but syndrome. It's like a version of Tourette's where we just can't stop saying, yeah, but. Like, it's because you talk, and all I'm doing is waiting for you to stop so I can start. And I start off with, yeah, but. And so it's just, I heard you, but I'm going to say something completely different than what you just said. I'm not going to interact with what you just offered me. We do that all the time. But there's the reason we do that is not just because we have this, like, inherent sense of a sort of resistance to just truth in general, but there's real consequences to this kind of thing. Truth has a price. It almost always has some level of price. And so what I want to talk about is that price, how we can get people to see the price of truth and why it is that that keeps them from accepting the good news of the gospel, how to expose it, but then also how to share the value of that truth despite the costs that are there. Along the way, we probably will see at least some evidence of the fact that it's a very costly call to be a Christian today. If you were raised in a Christian home and if you've believed it your whole life and you're decades into it, you will find that there are costs to pay just from being you. How many of you have experienced this phenomenon where you're in a office, a cube, whatever it is where you work, and a sensitive issue comes up? Let's say it's gender. Let's say it's sexuality. Let's say it's anything. And the volume in your voice drops a few decibels. And you didn't even do it consciously. Or you're in a restaurant, and you're speaking about something, and you're talking about something pretty animatedly with the person you're there in the restaurant with, but then the waitress walks up, and suddenly your voice goes down. Because you realize there's a consequence to the very thing I'm going to say next, and it might result in either something you didn't ask for in your food that you didn't see, or something worse, maybe a loss of a job or something like that. I say that because we're in a culture right now in which the cancel culture is a kind of culture where Jesus has never actually been more relevant. Despite the efforts to cancel him as irrelevant, ancient, and outmoded, he's actually never been more relevant than he's ever been in this moment now here in the West. Not just in the Middle East, not just in the East, but here in this moment in the West. Let me sustain that for you. Let's start off with an illustration. There was a few years ago. By the way, when you're a speaker, a few years ago can mean anything. It was pre-COVID, so it was more than a few. I was doing a skeptics night. Now, we do a bunch of different things. I do these open forums at universities where we just have a topic of discussion for 20 minutes, open it up to the floor for the faculty, for the students to ask questions, whatever it is. Well, I wanted to start that up at churches as well because it used to be the case that the church was the first place a skeptic would go to or a doubter would go to with their questions about God. Now, in the current cultural climate, it's the last place. Which is not fair, but that's the way the culture has moved. So a skeptics night brings people from the community who would never darken the door of a church and say, hey, they're taking my question seriously, I want to go to that. So I was doing one of those in a Canadian city. And it just so happened that the pastor of that church had connected with a young Muslim guy who was on a search for truth. And he had been interacting with various Christian apologists online and seeing the veracity of and the sustainability of the Christian faith. And he was looking at Muslim apologists and Christian apologists, really seeing that this Christian stuff is worthy of his exploration. But he couldn't bring himself to come to faith. Well, he didn't live too far. He had just moved to an area. He wasn't too far from the church I was speaking at in Canada. And so the pastor arranged to bring him to the service, the Skeptics Night service. I met him ahead of time. We spent some time together before the actual event started, and we chatted about his questions. And you could tell from his answers to the questions that I was raising to him that he had already basically intellectually assented to the truth of the Christian faith. And there's a difference between intellectually assenting to something and embracing it as true. That's why our ministry is called what it's called. It's not about getting you to intellectually assent to the credibility of the gospel. It's about embracing it, because I did that for a long time. I assented, but never embraced. And then when I finally embraced, I found the liberty that I was looking for. Well, this young man was in the assent phase. Not assent in terms of rise. I mean assenting like saying, yes, I agree. I assent to that statement. So he was assenting to everything in terms of the core claims of the Christian faith, had some questions left over, but really couldn't bring himself to come to faith. And he didn't say why. I knew why. I was there. I was this young man. He comes from the East. He comes from an honor and shame culture. He comes from, he's an Indian guy, a Muslim Indian guy. I do the open forum. We answer questions. He didn't ask one, not even a single question at the microphone or by text. Didn't even ask one. And I knew why. He'd already asked me a bunch, but he still had some left over, but didn't decide to do it publicly for whatever reason. And I think I know the reason. Then the crowd clears out, and he's still there. And me and a colleague sit down with him and start to chat with him very intimately in terms of what his hang-ups actually were. And this is exactly what happened. We're sitting on the bench. I have the permission to share this story, by the way. Sitting down on the pew. It's just me and him, my colleague, and the pastor who invited me. And I sat talking with him for a while. And again, he was just saying, he even said the words, this is true, this is true, this is true. And so I asked him, what's holding you back? I know the answer already. What's holding you back? And this young guy from the East, sitting there looking at his shoes as if the answer to life's questions were written on the top of them, just wouldn't look up. And the tears begin to fall, and they're hitting the tops of his shoes. And these are the words he said to me. My father has never told me he's proud of me. And if I become a Christian, he never will. My father has never told me he's proud of me. And if I become a Christian, he never will. Every man in this room knows what that fear is like, even when you had a tremendously great relationship with your father, someone who was nurturing and caring. You have this desire, an innate desire, a good desire to want to get the approval of your dad. And if you didn't have a relationship with your dad, you know even the ache is even a bigger yawn of an ache for that kind of a thing. You wish you had a dad who could be disappointed in you. You know that. In the East, when you have an honor and shame culture where everything is done to honor the family and the community, and everything is done to avoid shame for the community, this is a big part of what's going on here. So there's a real tension here. You see, in the West, we have what's called an innocence and guilt culture. We're very individualistic. If I do something bad, if I wrong somebody, there's this sense in which my individual conscience will be pricked, and I'll need to do something to fix the situation. I'll have a hard time sleeping, I'll feel guilty about something, enough to the point where I'll go and try to rectify the situation. So I go to the wronged person, I go and I fix the situation, and so because I have done something bad and became guilty, I do something good, and I make up for it, and now I'm innocent, or at least I'm absolved or redeemed or whatever it is. So because we're highly individualistic, I don't become someone bad. I do something bad and I can fix it. And because I have this inner sense of morality. Now in the East, they're no less moral. It's just that inner sense of morality bleeds out to the rest of the community. And so morality is enforced communally. Like what you do and say and think and act like has a reflection on everybody around you. And so in order to increase the level of honor for your family and for your community, you do that which is honorable. And if you do something shameful, the community will let you know. And you can sometimes fix it. But there's a hard part to this whole thing, you see. You see, in an innocence and guilt culture in the West where it's highly individual, there's a good aspect of this. An individualistic culture is the kind of culture that breeds innovation. It breeds the breaking forward through barriers, pioneering, go West, young man, all this kind of stuff. Frank Sinatra songs about doing it my way, you know, and all this kind of stuff. It's highly individualistic. The shadow side to that is that we're so individualistic that we don't care how our actions or our beliefs affect other people. Get over it. This is my life. Deal with it. We say that kind of stuff. That doesn't happen in the East and in the Middle East. In the Middle East and in the East, where it's an honor and shame culture, is that I strive to do that which brings honor to myself, but what brings honor to me is what brings honor to my family. So what I do, the beauty of that is that I care about what I do and what I say and what I think and what I believe to the extent that it hurts other people or brings honor to other people. So I'm worried about the honor and the shame. The shadow side to that in the East is that what ends up happening is you'll believe something that's false, even though you know it's false, because believing it keeps your honor. And you'll reject things that are true because rejecting it keeps you from feeling shame, which is why you can have someone from a Middle Eastern or an Eastern background or whatever it happens to be, and they'll look at you and you'll have that tremendous argument in your favor for the Christian faith or for whatever it might be, and they'll smile politely or maybe even not so politely at you, and they won't move at all. And it's not because they don't hear the force of what you're saying, they hear the consequence of what you're saying in their own life. Now, don't look now, but cancel culture is just an Eastern honor and shame culture enforced on social media. It's imported. Western cancel culture is an import from the East. You're welcome. We imported that to you guys. What that means, though, the reason why there's a good side to this, cancel culture is just an honor and shame culture enforced through the technorati. If I have enough followers, I can completely smear you. If you happen to say the wrong thing, if you happen to have the wrong speak, as it were, or say what you want, ask J.K. Rowling all about it. The author of the Harry Potter books, the most wealthiest author in the history of the world, is facing all kinds of issues because she believes that men and women are actually biologically separate things. And they've threatened her with death, and they've tried to cancel her left, right, and center. It's just an honor and shame system, Western style. Jesus operated in his ministry and in his life in an honor and shame culture, which makes him more relevant now than he was even in the 80s. You know, Leslie Newbegin has this wonderful phrase where he says that the Bible is our eternal contemporary. It's eternal. It always applies, but it always applies now. There's something about it that speaks to the issues you and I are facing now. Because of that, though, because now in the West, and it's been going on for quite some time, it's reached its zenith because of social media. Because of this, we've seen a developing resistance to the ideas of truth. And even when people know if something's true, they're still willing to reject it because of the consequences of that thing. There's a duplicity to this whole thing. You know, C.S. Lewis points this out, though. Now, C.S. Lewis writing decades and decades ago, had a bit of a prophetic voice, not in a charismatic gift of the Spirit kind of a way, but in a way that he saw things coming well before they actually happened. And he says this about the way in which we look for truth or comfort in this world, and ultimately we need to look for truth. He says this: if you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will get neither comfort nor truth, only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin with, but in the end, despair. If you look for truth, you'll get comfort. That will happen. It might not be on the side of heaven, by the way, but you will get comfort at some point. But if your primary goal is comfort, you'll get neither truth nor comfort, only soft soap to begin with, something easy and malleable and light and something that sort of smells, it covers up the smell, but you didn't wash anything off. And you'll end up in despair. That's Lewis. He says it, and he says it so right. You know, there's a profundity, a depth to this whole thing about how we look for truth, but the price, the consequences of it are just so very, very deep, and they can cause us to not really see the truth for itself. It actually distorts our view of reality, the fear of the consequences of coming to the truth, especially in a post-truth culture where truth is something we don't care about unless it happens to help us. So Scripture speaks to this. Thinking of its eternally contemporary mode, you see evidence of this in the Scriptures. You see it all the time. You apply it to your own life, you'll see the parallels immediately. John chapter 18, verses 37 to 38. You know, you have this situation where Pilate is before Jesus. Jesus is on trial, and he's before Pontius Pilate. He's just got tried by the Jewish religious leaders, and then he's getting tried by Pilate, the Roman leader. And what's interesting is in both trials, he wasn't the one on trial, they were. And in this particular instance, Pilate thinks he's the one with power, and Jesus, of course, says, "You don't have any power that wasn't given to you. If I wanted to, this would all be over. I could call legions like that, and you'd have nothing to stand on. But I'm here of my own accord. I'm exactly where I need to be." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Other translations, if you're on the side of truth, you listen to me. In other words, what Jesus is saying is that if you could take a concept like truth and make it sound like something, it would sound like me. His very voice is exactly what truth sounds like. Now, in that situation, with all the time he has and all the power he has to be able to have a conversation with Jesus, he could ask Jesus any question he wants. And he actually asks in words the most important and the best question he could ask at that moment when Jesus says, "If you are of the truth or on the side of truth, you hear my voice." The best question you could ask in that moment probably is the one Pilate did ask, which is, "What is truth?" And you can ask it in two ways. You can ask it as, "What is truth? What is that?" Or you can say, "What is truth?" and walk out. And Pilate chooses the second one. He chooses the second one. Now, when I say that is because there's a profoundness to this whole thing. There's a depth to the reason why Pilate does that. And you look and you see something, there's a hint of this in the New Testament where you see this incident in which Pilate's wife, Claudia, has a dream about Jesus, and she's so disturbed about this dream that she comes to Pilate and says, "Have nothing to do with this man, for I was greatly disturbed in a dream by a dream of him. I have nothing to do with this man." So you get this idea that Claudia is onto something, and she talks to Pilate about it. And now, if you've ever seen the movie The Passion of the Christ, which I'm sure you have because it's sort of a requirement now, if you're evangelical, you have to have seen this movie, which is funny because it's made by a Catholic. But there's a scene in The Passion of the Christ. Maybe you remember it. This scene is depicted, and Pilate finds out that Jesus is Galilean, so he sends him off to Herod to be judged. He's like, "Oh, I can wash my hands of this. This is not my jurisdiction. I get to send him off to Herod to be judged." And he goes and gets in this mock trial thing that happens with Herod and his buffoonery. But in the middle of that, he sends Jesus away, and he's troubled, and he sits down at the steps, and Claudia, his wife, walks in. Now, Claudia walks in, and she says, "What's troubling you," essentially. And Pilate says, this is not in the Bible, but it's consistent with what the Bible says. Pilate says to Claudia, he says, "What is truth, Claudia?" He asks the same question, different tone. "What is truth, Claudia? Do you know it when you hear it? What does it sound like?" Basically, based on Jesus' statement. And she says, "Of course I do. Don't you?" He says, "How? How can you know it?" And she says, "If you won't hear the truth, no one can tell you. It's a matter of the will. It's a matter of the will." And then Pilate gets really upset at Claudia and says, "Truth? You want to know what my truth is, Claudia? Here's my truth, Claudia. My truth is that I've been putting down rebellions in this rotten, godforsaken outpost for 11 years now. And if I let this man go, Caiaphas' people will start a riot. And if I don't let this man go, his followers may start a riot. In either instance, Claudia, there will be bloodshed, and Caesar has warned me. He has warned me twice now that the next time there's an uprising, it will be me on that cross. That's my truth." You know what's interesting about that whole conversation? He never spoke about truth one time. He used the word, but he was talking about the consequences of truth. Here he is talking to a man, and there's something about him that Pilate finds, I don't know about this, something goofy here. His own wife gets a dream, but Pilate chooses the coward's road. In fact, let me say this, Pilate doesn't just choose the coward's road, Pilate chooses the cynic's road. He's the cynic. See, there's a difference between being a skeptic and being a cynic. It's very, very different. You know, you look at someone like Thomas, right? So Thomas lived and did ministry with Jesus for 3 years, and he spent time with Peter and the boys, and they all did their thing, you know? And they saw these wonderful miracles, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 7,000, the raising of Lazarus from the dead, the healing of the blind people, a young lady who is risen from the dead, the multiplication of all these various things. He sees all of this, and then his hopes are completely dashed because the person he thought would deliver the Jews from the hands of the Romans dies at the hands of the Romans at the behest of the Jews. He's shattered. Then he hears reports from his friends, people he trusts and loves and will trust his life to, saying, we've seen the Lord risen. And he says, I won't believe until I can see with my own eyes and feel with my hands the scars. And what does Jesus do? He walks through that locked room and he says, Shalom Alechem. He points out the scars and says to Thomas, this is your peace. Peace be with you. Feel it. If you need to feel it, go ahead. And he does. And Thomas gets so inspired when he says, my Lord and my God, then he spends his time going after that to India where he is martyred for his proclamation of the gospel in that country, the same country where that young man came from, where he was afraid of the cost of truth. Thomas was so willing to pay the cost of truth so that that Indian young man could hear the gospel 2,000 years later. But Thomas was a skeptic. He was a skeptic. Doubts aren't dirty words if they drive you to find the truth. A skeptic is someone who won't believe until there's enough good reason. A cynic is someone who won't believe even when there is. And the question you have to ask yourself when you're reaching out to your friends, when you're trying to make a difference in this world for the cause of the gospel is who are you talking to? A skeptic or a cynic? Now, you can't just wash your hands of the cynics. Can't just do that, because sometimes cynics turn into skeptics, and then skeptics into believers. But it's very incumbent upon you to recognize who you're dealing with at that particular moment. You see, for Pilate, the cost of truth is so powerful that it can often distort reality, just like those Jews who had said, we are children of Abraham and never been enslaved to anyone. It distorts reality, you know. But then you look at someone like that, and I can firsthand attest to this, when the cost is so powerfully, it's so palpable, it's all you can think of, you need to figure out a way to move it out of the way, to move it out of the way. You know, we just experienced a solar eclipse, right? I mean, you're aware of this, right? It's not news. There was a total solar eclipse, and I could go on and on about the majesty of how that happens and how the ratio of the size of the earth, to the moon, to the sun, relative to its distance to the earth, and how God has finally tuned the only planet in the solar system or in the universe that we're aware of that has actual perfect solar eclipses, also happens to be the only planet that has observers of solar eclipses on them. And you think to myself, my goodness, all this balancing act is amazing. Yes, that's fantastic. But here's the thing. How is it that this small dead rock, which is millions of times smaller in volume than our sun, can block out the glorious radiance of the sun and make it dark? How's that possible? It's because the moon is so close to us. We hold this cold, dead rock close to us, and it blocks out and makes things cold. Did you notice that? It makes things cold. The cost of truth is like that. It's this cold, dead rock that we hold close to us, and it blocks out the gorgeous, radiant sun that God has provided for each one of us. And so it's incumbent upon the Christian, and I don't know what part of your life you need to have the cold, dead rock removed from, but for so many in this world, I'm an evangelist at heart. That's what I do. I see these costs of truth, and I say it's incumbent upon us as Christians to take that and somehow move the rock out of the way so they can see the Son of God who is there for each one of us and say that cost is something that's real. It's not an illusion. We need to move it so you can see the Son who's behind. How do we do it? How do we do it? The first thing I want to point out is that we can do this by asking questions. asking open-ended questions. And I'm going to race through. I'm going to skip a couple of things to get through to some things just so for Q&A time. I'm going to get right to the method. We can ask open-ended questions. We can question our questioners. We can find out what's going on behind the scenes. You know, one of the things that I point out often in our ministry is that our ministry doesn't exist to answer questions. I love doing Q&A, but I don't answer questions. I hope I never fall into the trap of answering questions. I hope I never do this. I don't want to answer questions. I just don't. You look at Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, and I may be skipping ahead, so pardon me if I do so, but sometimes the word just pops up and you got to say it when it pops up in your head. Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6 is the hallmark of the mission of what our ministry is all about. Embrace the Truth is based on this particular passage of Scripture where Paul says, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Now, I could go on and on about what it is that a Mediterranean Middle Easterner is doing, telling you to make the best use of the time. I don't know if you've been around Middle Easterners or if you're a Middle Easterner. We're notorious for not making the best use of the time. It takes an hour and a half to say hello. I'll say marhaba, they'll say marhabtain. That's two hellos back, by the way, because now we're in a competition to be who's more polite. And then I'll say marahib, which means many. He'll say alf marahib, which is 1,000 hellos. And before you know it, we're in this competition to see who's more hospitable. And I have to ask about his dog and his neighbor's wife and his neighbor, you know, his mother and the health and what's going on with a thing on her neck and you know, all that stuff. And then we'll get to the topic of conversation. It's an hour and a half later. So Paul's from that culture, Middle Eastern culture. He knows what it's like to be wasteful with time, but not really wasteful. He's basically saying, answer the question they're actually asking you. Don't answer the one that you want them to ask you and that you prepared for. Put your pet theory away for a moment. Answer what's going on in the moment. And then he says this wonderful thing where he says, let your speech be gracious, seasoned with salt, so you may know how you ought to answer each person or everyone, depending on your translation. But I want you to notice something, friends. He doesn't say answer each question. He doesn't say answer each controversy. He doesn't say answer each issue. He doesn't do that. He doesn't say do that. He says answer each person. Here's the fundamental reason why. Because questions, answers, and controversies don't need answers. People need answers, and they use their questions and issues and controversies to get those answers. But fundamentally, you and I are not in the question-answering business. We're in the people-answering business. And every person is different. You put a label on them, skeptic, atheist, leftist, Marxist, super far right, ultra this, you know, whatever you want to do. Tea Party, I don't know what the things people call each other now are anymore. These labels we put on each other so easily. But they're all different. And they all have some kind of a baggage behind them. How do you answer the questions? And so Paul says, let your speech be gracious, seasoned with salt, so you can know how you ought to answer each person. You've noticed something? That when you talk, you don't get to know, you don't get to learn anything? Now Paul says, let your speech be gracious, so you can learn something about how you can answer a person. What Paul is basically saying is that, first, present the gospel beautifully when you do in fact speak. When it's your time to speak, do it beautifully, seasoned with salt, so it's savory and they want it to be true. But he's also saying this, fundamentally, is he's saying that you could ask questions in a meaningful and winsome way so that you'll know what this person's issue is. So you can walk in wisdom toward that outsider because you've asked a question with seasoned and salty and gracious questions. So now you know the hang-up they actually have. So you're answering the person, not the question. Don't answer the worldview. Don't answer the philosophy. Don't answer the political theory. Answer the person. Why do they hold that theory? Why are they a Muslim? Why are they a Hindu? Why are they a Buddhist? Why are they an atheist? Why are they a nominal Christian? Why are they left, right, center, or up and down, or whatever happens to be at the moment? The first way you do that is to ask open-ended questions. Now, the way I would ask open-ended questions, I wish someone had done this with me earlier on in my own faith journey. Maybe that 9 years would have been, you know, 8.5. I don't know. But I wish they would have asked me questions about the motivation I had for the conversations. You see, I was an evangelist for Islam. I would try to knock the faith out of anybody who had some level of faith in something, or even in no faith. I'd say atheism's ridiculous, come be a Muslim, whatever it was. And I would try to get them to change their minds and become a Muslim. At some point, you know, a lot of these people were coming and talking to me with the credibility of the Christian faith, and I found it to be a little too credible. Like it was very uncomfortably credible. I didn't like that it was credible. It bothered me that it was making sense. And I don't think I recognized that consciously at first. What ended up happening to happen was I began to realize at a conscious level that it wasn't that I couldn't believe because there wasn't enough good reason, it's that I wouldn't believe because there was far too many consequences. And if someone had asked me an open-ended question, like this simple one, why do you believe what you believe? Or this even better one, I often ask this question at some point in the conversation. Let's assume for a moment that we've been talking for a while in a conversation about faith. Let's assume for a moment that I convinced you that Christianity was true. Let's assume further that you agreed with me that it was in fact true. And one more assumption is that you became a Christian right now because you believed it was true. What would happen next? What's the next thing that would happen? If you're a Muslim, a Hindu, a Buddhist, anybody of religious background, especially from the East, they already know the answer. They already know the answer. Would your family throw a party? How would that go? I want you to think about the profundity of this, how deep this actually can be, okay? You're all believers in this room, at least I assume that to a certain degree, although I've been in enough of these rooms when I was a Muslim to recognize that in any crowd of people, there's always people who either aren't really believers, who are skeptics, who are looking into it, or people who have been going to church for a long time and have been play-acting and have been afraid to express their doubts. So I don't want to assume anything about you, except that the for the Christians in here, I would say this. Let's say I could pull out a box of bones, and I could genetically prove, I don't know how I would possibly do this, but let's say I could genetically prove those are Jesus' bones. Those are his actual bones. He died and he's still dead. And I could prove it and you had no reason to doubt me. How hard would it be, even with all that evidence, for you to give up your faith? What does tomorrow morning look like on a Sunday morning when everyone wants to go to church and you're like, but I know something you don't know? Think about how hard that would be. How your Bible studies would change, how your friendships might change, how your conversations would change. And that's here in America where it's free to disbelieve. Now multiply that by 1,000 and you have a lot of people in the world for whom belief is a consequence that might be a little more painful than what we might think here, even though it's becoming increasingly uncomfortable to become a Christian or to stay a Christian in this country. So if you ask that question, what would happen if you became a Christian today, it wakes up something in people. They suddenly realize that there's a consequence to this whole thing. You know, there was a Muslim guy. I'll give you a couple of stories from Muslim and non-Muslim. I went to a hospital to visit this guy. I don't know him. I've never met him before. But there was a chaplain who was someone who was going and doing, you know, ministry at this one particular hospital. She was a woman, and she was doing chaplain work at this particular hospital. She heard about my story, and she says, hey, there's this Muslim guy I've been trying to witness to. He's going in for a very serious surgery, very soon. He's been ill for a long time, and he's pretty scared. We're talking about Jesus, talking about the gospel and all this stuff, but he's a little more resistant. But also, there's a little bit of a language barrier, and there's also the whole barrier of gender issues. You know, me in a room alone with him, it's kind of making him uncomfortable. Would you come and talk with him? So I said, sure, I'd be happy to come talk with him. So I go to talk with him, and I walk into his room. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, you've been in a situation where you can walk into a room and you can smell the sick. You can sort of smell the illness. He's not disgusting. He's not like throwing up all over. He's just ill. And there's tubes and stuff and all that, and he's got hooked up to this and that. He's still conscious, still talking. And there he is, this bald, slightly overweight, older man. And I said to him, Ammo, which means uncle. He's not my uncle. That's what we do in the East. You call somebody who's not your uncle just because they're older than you and you respect them. So I said, Ammo, please sit down. He went to stand up and say hello to me. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Sit down. So I said, Ammo, please sit. I noticed something. I noticed something immediately about the room. There's no food. There's a hospital tray, but I don't know if you know this, but I got enough relatives who've been in the hospital to know this. As a Lebanese person, someone's in the hospital, you sneak contraband in, you know, and it's all falafel and hummus and kebabs and all this stuff, right? There should be bags of food in his room. Nothing. Nothing. No one's visited him yet. So I know that. I noticed that. So I asked him about family and all this, and he basically told me that, you know, he's either his wife had passed or she had divorced. I couldn't remember exactly which, but his wife wasn't around in the picture, and his children were coming from overseas on their way because he was having this grave surgery. They were on their way over. So we started talking about, he says, I heard you became Christian. You know, maybe you can help me. You can answer my questions. And I'm like, I don't know if I can answer your questions. We'll give it a shot. So we did. We had a long conversation. And I got to tell you something. The stony mask over his face did not break. No cracks in it whatsoever. No matter how compelling my argument was, it didn't crack. And then I thought to myself, I'm gonna pull out the family card and ask him about his family and the issue there with all that. And I said, you know, Amo, we've been talking for some time now. If you became a Christian, and you've been so gracious to me, but if you became a Christian, what would happen? And he, in this moment of honesty, says to me, I would die alone in this country. And a tear escaped his eye. You know, all my argumentation was one thing, but recognizing and saying, Amo, I know what that's like. I know what it feels like to worry about that. That's when the stone cracked. That's when it cracked. You recognize someone's consequences to this kind of thing and you begin to talk about it. Counter that with a young man I was talking to recently. He was an atheist young man sitting at a table with him. And he had some pretty serious questions. And he says, we're going back and forth. He has this notebook full of stuff from these various philosophers. Loves Nietzsche. So I said, have you read the responses to Nietzsche? To Nietzschean philosophy? He's like, no, not really. I'm like, so you haven't read all the Christians that have responded to Nietzsche over the course of the decades? No, not really. He named another philosopher, another atheist philosopher. Said, have you read the responses to that guy? No, not really. He kept on going back and forth with all these people that he's read that take pot shots at the Christian faith, but hasn't read any of the responses to them. I said, you know, it's fascinating to me that you've read all of the things that are against the Christian faith, but none of the stuff that defends the Christian faith. Why is that? Why is that? And we began to talk. He didn't answer. We began to talk for some time, and we talked about objective morality, morality being an objective feature of the universe, of reality. And he said this, these are his words, I can't go there. I can't get to objective morality. I said, why not? He says, because then I'd have to believe in God, and I don't want to. I said, ah, there it is. That's the issue. That's what's going on here. It's not a matter of whether there's enough evidence. It's a matter of your will. I said, do you agree with me? And I said this to him. I said, do you agree that the most important question for you is not, does God exist? That's not the most important question for you. The most important question for you is, why do I want him not to exist? Because I can give you all the reasons that he exists, but if you don't want them, what's the point? Do you want truth or do you want comfort? And what are your issues? And he told me, basically he admitted to me over the course of this time what the real issues were. And they had nothing to do, really, with the intellectual credibility of the gospel, had everything to do with his personal stuff. You see, everyone has this. I can quote to you a bunch of people, Thomas Nagel out of New York University, who wrote the statement, and he said, I want atheism to be true. It's not that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my beliefs, it's that I don't want the universe to be like that. Nothing to do with the evidence, everything to do with desire. It's a fundamental part of what it means to be human. So if we ask the question, what would happen if you became a Christian, oftentimes that will percolate to the top, we'll see the response, the people will see it. Second thing you can do to expose truth cost is to just listen to the answers. This is the hardest part, by the way. Asking questions is easy. Listening to the answer without jumping in, that's the hardest part. Sometimes the cost of the truth, of whatever the truth is, effervesces and bubbles up to the top. I'll give you a short story about this. I'll give you one from a Muslim perspective and then one from an atheist perspective. A woman called me on the phone. I had become a Christian, and it became public about 2 weeks before this phone call. I got this new landline, back when people had landlines. I moved into a house. I have a new home and all this stuff, and then I have a landline, and the phone rings. I'm like, oh, I'm excited. Someone's calling my house. So I pick up the phone, and this woman, and she's got an Arabic accent, and she says, I heard you became a Christian. How can you do this? Now, I couldn't wait to unload the dissertation from Augustine Zwingli. You know, I gave it to her, man. This is why I became a Christian. Here's the da-da-da. 20 minutes later, how you like me now? And she said, that's all very interesting, but I wanted to know, was it worth it? how could you become a Christian knowing it would cost you everything? She wanted to know, was it worth it? Now, I could have just listened and asked her, what do you mean? And I would have had a much shorter conversation that didn't have so much of me trying to brag about me in the conversation. I could have just listened. Young Palestinian guy. I was at a talk, this is years ago, before all this stuff happened. I was at a talk where I was giving the evidence for the resurrection as a historical matter, and he was there in the audience. And afterwards, his Christian friend brought him over to me and said, would you talk to him? He's got some questions. I'm like, of course I will. So we sat down, and he had a lot of questions about the resurrection, the historicity of the resurrection. Bright kid. Oh my goodness, how bright this guy was. How articulate and erudite he was. He was a very impressive person. But I will say this, and this is with all the respect that's due to him, and plenty of it is due to him, actually. His objections, as I began to answer them, got, frankly, dumber and dumber. Or more desperate. Like, he was bringing up objections that no one believes anymore, and he kind of knows it. So there's a desperation of running from this truth. And so I thought, there's a resistance here, so it's probably a cost of truth issue. So I asked him about his family. You know, would this, in fact, be a negative impact on his family? He's like, no. I haven't talked to them in years. We're estranged. Talked in years, so that eliminated that issue. And I just listened after that. And so after the back and forth, it finally came up. He said, let me ask you a question. You're Lebanese, former Muslim, whose family hails from the south of Lebanon. How is it possible that you as a Christian believe that everything Israel does to us is okay? We don't count? We don't matter? I said, well, wait. What does that have to do with anything? We're talking about the resurrection of Jesus. How does that have to do with anything? He says, my friend here tells me that when I become a Christian, I have to unilaterally support Israel no matter what it does to my people or to the people I love back home. That's what he tells me. And I'm like, oh, this is a side issue, man. This is not a core issue. So what do you do in that moment? See, what happened was I didn't ask him about that. That just bubbled up. But I listened. I paid attention. And so this is my response to him in that particular moment. I said, you know, this is an important question. There's no question about the level of depth of importance of this. In fact, my first book was about this issue. That's not here available. It's out of print now. But I said, you know what's interesting about this is that we've been talking about the resurrection for some time now, and now you brought up this issue about ethnicity and, you know, different people and land and all that stuff, and the Bible talks about it. Read John chapter 4. You'll see that. But the issue we're talking about is whether or not Jesus rose from the dead to prove that he paid for your sin. If that's the case, if he did in fact rise from the dead to pay for your and my sin, doesn't that mean that even if there are questions about justice and fairness and equality on this side of heaven that we won't get answers to necessarily, we won't get them on this side, but we will on the other side? Doesn't the resurrection, if it's true, give you hope that all the things that are unfair about this world will be set right eventually, even if we can't do it with our policies and our procedures and our various factions? And he said, you know what? If he rose from the dead, then yeah, there are answers to those questions. Let's continue. Sometimes the gospel has a way of cutting right through these things. So you ask, and then you listen. And then the third thing you have to do is commit. Now, I want to race through this. My watch is dead. You commit. Because it's a great commission, not the great suggestion. And in that great commission, what you have to do, friends, is commit to following someone and being with them when they realize there's a price to pay. When they say, hey, I know there's a price to pay, and you show me there's a price to pay, but when I pay it, where will you be? Now, I'm okay with spot evangelism. I do it on planes all the time. I do it all the time at universities where I talk to somebody about evangelism and I don't become a part of their life later on. I try to get them involved with a healthy Christian community or hook them up with somebody who can do some follow-up. But the reality is most of you most of us will encounter people on a one-on-one level in our conversations. And what they need to know is that will you help them to be to be able to pay that cost because you'll be community to them. You'll be community to them. If you're not, then they don't have any reason on this side of heaven to think that you're trustworthy or that you care about them as people. So commit. Now, how do you share truth's worth? I think that when we find that the answers are to their deepest struggles, like that Palestinian young man, that there are answers to your deepest struggles and the gospel can provide those. I think that you see this in various places throughout the entirety of the Bible. And I don't have time to necessarily go into those things. But you see, there's answers to our deepest struggles. The Bible gives you those answers. But it also promises you that you're going to have these costs to pay and that Jesus himself, who's paid those prices, will be with you in those struggles and the community will be with you. Why is it worth it to pay those costs? I can tell you personally that the times it's been the most tough to be a Christian, when it's been the hardest in the world to be a Christian, that's when it's been the most valuable. It's when I found my relationship with Jesus to be simply the most valuable. You know, you see these the reality of your value and my value. It's becoming harder and harder to become a Christian, to stay a Christian now. You know, you say something that's Christian, you're labeled a bigot, you're labeled whatever, you're labeled an exclusivist, and you're canceled in whatever fashion or form. It's happening more and more. I wouldn't call it persecution yet. It's not there yet. You look at the outside world, go to the Middle East, go to China, and you'll talk about persecution then. We're still free to do this. I don't know if you've noticed, we're gathering right now. So we're still free to do that. But maybe there's a time when that won't happen. I don't know. But it's becoming very difficult to stay Christian or to express yourself as a Christian. Legally speaking, it's becoming more difficult. But when you pay those prices, when that becomes difficult, there's a certain level to which there's a blessing that can't come from any, the blessing that is of a depth of which cannot come from any other expression of Christian faith other than to express your Christianity when it's really hard. There's a blessing you get from suffering in a way you don't get from anything else. We heard about it during lunch. Thank you, brother, for that. Amen. Dovetailed so nicely with what I'm saying. But second is that you know your value. You know, how valuable do you know something actually is? How do you know how valuable something is? You know how valuable something is by what you're willing to pay for it. That's how you know how valuable something is. And so, if Jesus is who he said he was, then each one of us can know that we have an infinite value because the infinite God paid an immeasurable price to spend eternity with you. That's a fact. That's an objective value. Every human being has a value because a price was paid that's infinite. And so our value is infinite. So the benefits of believing this stuff, even when it's hurting on this side of heaven, is that you know the value you have because of the infinite one. And then finally, friends, you get to see who God really is. You get a revelation of God's true character. And you see the hope that he provides to the rest of the world. So there is an atheist named Matthew Paris. And there's plenty of people who are like this now who are seeing this. Richard Dawkins just recently said that cultural Christianity, he's a cultural Christian. The world's most famous atheist just recently said he's a cultural Christian because he finds the beauty and the value in the Christian message that's helped to form the Western world. Now, little does Dr. Dawkins know that you can't have a Christian cultural message without actual Christian truth, but that's another matter altogether. But Matthew Paris went back to Africa. He was born in what's now called Malawi. It was then called Nyasaland. And what he saw there so inspired him by the way the gospel had actually impacted the world that he had to write about it in an article called Why Africa Needs Christianity. An atheist wrote Why Africa Needs Christianity, and he says essentially this. I'll just paraphrase it. He says, "Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa. Sharply distinct from the efforts of foreign NGOs and international aid, these alone will not do. Education and aid will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. The rebirth is real. The change is good." Global hope. That's worth paying the price. And then finally, recognizing God's character in your own life. In your own life. C.S. Lewis once again, in Mere Christianity, we pay a price to follow the truth, but God paid a greater price to offer us that truth. This is what Lewis says. But the great thing to remember is that though our feelings come and go, his love for us does not. It is not wearied by our sins or our indifference, and therefore it is quite relentless in its determination that we shall be cured of those sins at whatever cost to us, at whatever cost to him. And that's where the value of truth lies. It means that the truth values you infinitely. What's more worth it than that?